The tea has not yet come. So today, for the Chinese, as I usually give teachings, introduction to Buddhism to them. Chinese from the mainland, from Taiwan, Singapore, Malaysia, and mainland China. So I give Dharma discourse to them. And this time, in this very special sacred place, Vajrasana, so I have decided to do this the Dharma discourse for the Chinese audience. I have taught the Diamond Cutter Sutra once before. So this time I will be teaching in this text, the Vajracchedika Sutra, and preceding this, I also am thinking of doing the Heart Sutra. So usually we say some blessing for the tea when we have this when we take tea, but this time we don't have the blessing prayer because you have received the initiation in the last days, and therefore you can make the offering to yourself as a deity from having received the initiations in the last 2 days. So since you are taking this tea, since you are taking this tea within the perception that you are a deity taking the tea, don't say it is not tasty. So see, you should be able to see everything as being pure, within the pure realm. So this discourse, Dharma discourse, was so in the beginning, during this time, I gave teachings to Indian Buddhists, and also those Indians who are interested. So Buddhism originated in India, and Buddhism spread from here, and then Buddha himself was Indian, and Masters Nagarjuna and so forth were Indians. In the past, Nalanda was a very renowned monastic institution of learning. So Buddhism in general, and in particular the Nalanda tradition, and so tradition, Master Nagarjuna and so forth, are the ones who are revered highly by those following the Sanskrit tradition, whereas the Pali tradition is followed in Thailand, Burma, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, and so forth, and therefore they have the practice, an excellent practice of Vinaya and so forth, of the teaching of the Buddha. And with regard to the Sanskrit tradition, it spread from India to China, and from there to Korea, Japan, and so forth. And then also it spread from India to Tibet, and from there to Mongolia. So Buddhism spread to China before it came to Tibet already. So China was one of the earliest countries where Buddhism spread earliest. And then the Chinese people in different parts of the world, in different countries, when they have a big community, they always have some Buddhist temples. And then in Malaysia, Indonesia, although the national religions are different, but then because of the Chinese communities, they have Buddhism as well. And so Buddhism is something which is close to the Chinese heart. So with regard to the Chinese, Buddhism is their traditional religion. There's no talk of converting to Buddhism as such. So their forebears were Buddhists. And in 1954, October, I went to Beijing. And I visited different parts of China. In Xinjiang. Province and so forth, provinces, and there were many Buddhist temples. And then in Beijing, because of connection between the Chinese emperors and the Tibetan masters, there is a stupa which is which contains Yamantaka statue, and so I still clearly remember this. And so there was a strong link between the Tibetans and the Chinese, and so the Chinese were following Buddhism. And then during the Cultural Revolution, all religions were considered blind faith and were destroyed. I mean, there had been great effort to obliterate these traditions and by force. But it is quite natural that when people, there is this deep ingrained faith for thousands of years, I mean, even if by force people try to destroy that faith, Deng Xiaoping came to power then, and then he followed this principle of finding truth from facts. And therefore, since then, the faith in people's mind in China has been revived. And then particularly Buddhism is being revived in China itself. So about 3 or 4 years ago, perhaps from the Beijing University, there was a survey of the Buddhist population in China, and they said that it was 300 million. And then in the meantime, the number has grown to 400,000, according to my friends. And so there is this natural inclination to keep faith in the teaching of the Buddha. And so the Chinese here are taking interest in Buddhism, which is very good. You are actually taking care of your own forebears' treasure. So in this world, there are the major religious traditions are in India, for example. The earliest one was Sankhya school. And then from there, branching out from there, there were the Mimamsakas and the Jainas and the Nayakas and so forth, and also the Jainas. And so today also there are followers of the different philosophical schools of thought, such as Sankhya and also Jainism, and then Buddhism, and also later the Sikhism also developed in India. And so Sikhism, for example, has the respect for all different religions. And Guru Nanak, the founder of Sikhism, was someone who, in order to show non-sectarianism, visited Mecca, made a pilgrimage to Mecca. And so there are those of the homegrown religions. Homegrown religions of India, there are several different religions, and then the emigrated religions. The earliest may be Zoroastrianism, so the people who follow this are called Parsis. In Mumbai these days there are less than 100,000 people following this, but they live amongst the other people of other religious traditions peacefully, without any fear. And then from the Middle East, there are these religions that spread. Judaism and Christianity, which also immigrated to India. In other words, all the major religious traditions of the world are coexisting in India and living in harmony. And so the population of India is about 1.2 billion or so. So it's not about politics, but there is this religious harmony in India. And then China, being a traditional, a Buddhist country, and Xi Jinping several years ago said that Buddhism is one of the important part of Chinese culture in Paris and also in Delhi. He said this, and so this is true. So wherever people live, they're and because of their connection with their tradition and religion, of course, it's relevant to preserve their religious tradition. So the culture depends on the people's land, where the people live, the environment, and also their lifestyle, food, and so forth. And so religion is much influenced by the people's habit in their land. And so the religion also has much influence in their culture of the different peoples. And for example, in Mongolia, Buddhism has a great influence on people's culture, and also this is true with regard to Tibet and China. and therefore it is worth taking interest in their own traditional religion. So as a Buddhist, you all know that I'm a Buddhist monk, but I have respect for all religious traditions. If you really sincerely practice the religions, of course, you can see people who really are sincere practitioners of the different religious traditions. So it's a matter of whether you practice the religious tradition that you profess to be following. All the religions teach love, compassion, and so forth. Of course, never say that. I mean, philosophically, there may be differences amongst the religious traditions, and so I don't. Although there is difference, I never say that Buddhism is the best religion in the world. Never do I say this. And whether something is best or good or bad depends on individuals. And so, just as the medicine could be said to be best for somebody, and according to their physical condition and so forth. And so I never say that Buddhism is the best religion, and never try to put effort in propagating Buddhism in other parts of the world. So when it comes to philosophical ideas, the different religions have different philosophies. So most of the religious traditions of the world believe in the Creator God. And they say that this God, who is of infinite love, are our children. This infinite God creates us. And the God, the Creator, is that of infinite love. But there are these three religious traditions: non-theistic Sankhya school, and Jainism, and Buddhism, which say that there's no Creator God, and there's no beginning to the life of sentient beings. And so they explain the things coming into being through the law of causality. And so there are differences in philosophy. And so for some, the theistic religions are more suitable. So it is important to see the suitability of the religions. But nonetheless, the practice of love, which is taught in all religious traditions, is very important, not only for the religious people who follow the religious traditions, but even the people who have no faith in religions. Because otherwise, people say that love and compassion is something that has to do with religion, when they say they don't have, while they say they don't have any a faith in religions. So regarding Buddhism, the Buddha himself has said, monks and scholars, and just as a gold is tested by burning, rubbing, and cutting, likewise you should examine my teaching and then accept it, not because you have respect to me. And so accordingly, Masters like Nagarjuna and his followers have said that there's amongst the sutras taught by the Buddha, there are certain sutras which cannot be taken literally. For example, the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra, Sutra unraveling the thought or the intention of the Buddha, according to the Madhyamaka tradition, which does not assert any kind of objective existence. According to them, this sutra is a provisional sutra. So they follow reasoning rather than mere faith in following the teaching of the Buddha. And so it's in the Pali Sanskrit tradition which follows reasoning to explain the teaching of the Buddha and to demonstrate the truth of the teaching of the Buddha. Love, compassion, and so forth. That's wrong. And so regarding Buddhism, the Nalanda tradition follows, the Sanskrit tradition follows that of reason, according to the statement of the Buddha. And so in my childhood, I was interested in mechanical toys, and then I also began to grow interest in science in my childhood. And then when I visited China in 1954, I had visited industries, factories, and I was actually inquiring about the mechanical workings of the instruments and the workings of the machines and so forth. And Mao Zedong actually, at that time, when I was in China, told me that I have a scientific mind. And then after coming to exile, I also expressed the wish and desire to have discussions with scientists. And when I expressed this, one a Western American Buddhist follower of Buddhism told me that, be careful, science is killer of religion. But I reflected on the statement of the Buddha that I quoted earlier, which is, oh, monks and scholars, just as gold is tested and so forth. And so I reflected on that, and then there's an Nalanda Sanskrit tradition which follows reason rather than faith, and therefore I thought that there is no danger. And for example, I found that even in our scriptures, there are mentions of Mount Meru and so forth, which cannot stand to the test of reason and experiment, and go against reason and so forth. And so we cannot assert that. And then later, when I expressed the wish to to have the monastics learn science, many of the elder monks were quite hesitant, because they said that if they were to learn science, they also have to learn English, and that might be a distraction for their religious faith. And so, from my discussions with scientists, I have found that there is no contradiction in learning science for the monastics. And in fact, it really helps. There's a mutual benefit for the scientists and the Buddhists. And therefore, we started to have the teaching of science in the monastic institutions. And so, we can actually contribute to the scientists on regarding mind science and psychology and so forth, and they can also benefit us in terms of the physical physics and so forth. And so it is only the Nalanda tradition which can go in par with science.
So therefore, when it comes to the philosophical tenets, generally Buddhism and especially the Nalanda traditions, I can say that that is the best tradition. And I'm saying that out of my experience, having met many people through multiple discussions, I'm saying this. And this is a tradition, a philosophical system that can go at par with the scientist and go at par with scientists, and which is even beyond that. And nowadays, when people speak about science, they consider science as something fact, which comes to a conclusion through multiple experiments and so on. And I think that this is an important point, so please keep that in mind. So in order to come to that, it is important that we have to study. And I used to tell my Chinese Buddhist friends out of joke and out of half serious. So you always salute saying Amitabha and offer the red packet. So merely stating Amitabha and my prostrations, that is not enough. And also merely recitation of a sutra, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, is also not sufficient. So continue. And so those who are there are many temples and monasteries in China, not only the monks in China, but those who are interested. I think it is important to have classes and discussions on the philosophical standpoints. I think that will be very beneficial. Even in Tibetan community, I used to say that and even in the monastic community, not only those who are in the, not only the monks who are in the university, Buddhist universities, but all the community of the monks and nuns should be more important to study the Buddhist philosophical tenets. And that's the reason why we have a new graduated Geshe-mas recently. We have studied, the nuns who have studied for many years. And similarly for the layperson, I used to request all of them that it is important to study the Buddhist philosophical tenets. And that is the reason why I've seen a growth in the interest of study of Buddhism in general Tibetan community, and especially in the Himalayan regions. So therefore, it is important to study, for example, the quantum physics, the concept and the studies of the quantum physics that is explained by the Western scientists is still at the very beginning. But when we explain it through the Nalanda tradition, through the, especially through the Nagarjuna tradition, so we have reached a great another height compared to the Western scientists. And there is a physicist who is an Indian, and he told me that quantum physics, the concept, is pretty new in the Western world, but in India, it has been there for, the same concept has been there for over 2,000 years. And the reason and the proof for that, he's quoted the verse from one of the texts of Nagarjuna. So we can also, when we have dialogues and discussions with the quantum physicist and the other physicist, I've seen that those assertions and the philosophical standpoints coming from the mind-only school and the Madhyamika schools are very deep and very profound. And also from the Buddhist philosophical explanations about the mind and the psychologies coming from the Pramana and other texts are also very profound. So even a small monastery in the Himalayan regions, so even though you are a small monastery with lesser monks, so it is important that you have to study. And we should be able to gain a kind of understanding within our community that when we refer to a monastery or a temple, it is a place for learning. I think it was in 1965 or 1966. I visited Singapore. At that time, there were some bhikshus, the Chinese bhikshus, and they were reciting Heart Sutra, and it really moved me. In the mainland China, and they have the freedom to do the recitations of Heart Sutra in China, but they no more have that freedom. So at that time, it came to my mind that so this has been in practice for so many years in China. So at that time, I did some discourse, some permissions, and some small initiations. When I did those permissions, and the attendees are so attentive, but when I explained the teachings of Buddhism, some were dozing off and without paying much attention. So this is wrong. But there were some Westerners, so of course during the initiations, they really do prayers. But when I'm explaining, they take notes and they took great interest of what I'm trying to explain. So my Chinese Buddhists, so many of them were dozing and sleeping at that time. So just taking notes. And I think that you have heard many times, there is this, at that time the young monk said that the abbot went to frighten the villagers. So he sort of said that if we do not understand real teachings, and it is important, then we may say that it is important that you have to pray. And there may be also dangers of telling other people that you have to come to my temple to do the prayers. And making other people getting afraid towards teachings by frightening or generating fear in them is the wrong way. And the foundation of the teachings is explaining about the liberations and also telling them about the way to how to eliminate the afflicted emotions. And Lord Buddha has presented us a very clear path how to eliminate the afflicted emotions. So that's how we have to lead our disciples, but not by frightening them or generating fear, by telling them about the dangers and the sufferings that they may encounter or suffer in if they are born as a hungry ghost or hell realms. And I think the actual teaching of the Buddha is not to generate fear in the people. The teachings were based on Four Noble Truths, especially the truth of cessations and the path of cessations. Since there is a possibility to cease or eliminate the suffering, so therefore Lord Buddha taught about the path. And also when it comes to suffering, the types and the categories of the suffering, and the antidote and the countermeasure to eliminate the sufferings. So therefore, since having understood the suffering and the origin of or the causes of the suffering, so then Lord Buddha leads us, shows us the path that leads to that cessations. And as a sentient being naturally wanting happiness and not wanting suffering is something we do not need any reason to prove, it's natural. So generating faith towards the teachings is by one's own wish, but not out of generating fear. So when we speak about studying the Dharma or the teachings, many a time the term religions, many people can associate it with the faith. And So many scientists and Western philosophers say that Buddhism is a science of mind, but not a religion. I think there is some truth in it. So religion actually covers all the different traditions. So therefore, I usually spoke about the philosophical tenets. That philosophy, we have to study the philosophy of the different traditions. So when I give introduction to Buddhism, first I give introduction based on the philosophy. And after understanding the introduction of the Buddhism, then we can generate faith. So today here, we all gathered together. And in relation to the introduction of Buddhism, I wanted to assert and request you that it is important to study. And once you are back to your own country, so you have to work as hard as much as possible to study Buddhism. And if there is possibility to organize some classes or discussions and the dialogues, I want to request all of you to do that more.
So you need to have class, not just having some kind of a teaching from somebody who sits on a throne, but you should sit together and have discussions on Buddhist philosophy and so forth. So a friend of mine, to whom I told him that this person that it would be good when you go back to your hometown to give teachings to people. And then he asked me what kind of hat should he or she wear. I told him, no need. The Diamond Cutter Sutra. So his holiness read the title in Tibetan. And so in the Buddha's teachings, such as those of the Sutra of the Wise and the Foolish and so forth, there are accounts of the life of the Buddha himself, that what he had practiced in the past before becoming a Buddha. And so he became someone who became a fully enlightened being, a perfect Buddha, after having gone through training, study, practice, and so forth. And therefore, he became someone who is an enlightened being, fully enlightened being, through training his mind. And through that training and practice, due to those cause and conditions, he became someone who is omniscient with all the special qualities. And his teachings are different, therefore. And therefore, Masters Nagarjuna and so forth, when they explained the teaching of the Buddha through reason, it becomes very special teaching as well. And so this mind that of ours, which is unruly at this point of time, can be transformed and finally become a mind like the Buddha, Shakyamuni himself. So the Buddha, just after his enlightenment, said that this nectar-like dharma that is profound, peaceful, unfabricated, and clear light, and uncompounded, I have found if I were to teach it to others, no one will understand me. Therefore, I will remain silent in the forest. And so, of course, the Buddha in the common parlance of the people in that time must have gone through the practices of shamatha, vipassana, and so forth that were prevalent at that time. And so, through training his mind, the Buddha was became someone who called free from all faults and became someone fully replete with excellent qualities. And so he said, this profound, peaceful, unfabricated, clear light and uncompounded dharma, which is like a dharma nectar, I have found, and if I were to teach it to others, nobody will understand me. Therefore, he remained silent in the forest. And later, the Gaudiniya and so forth, whom the Buddha was familiar from the previous times, met with them, and they requested the teaching from the Buddha, and therefore the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, not some tantric initiation right away. And so, with regard to the Four Noble Truths, and each of them have four aspects each. And so the practice based on this is very comprehensive practice. And then the Buddha also taught the 37 factors of enlightenment, four mindfulness and then four exertions and so forth. So one friend of mine told me that there were different languages in India at that time, and the common language that was used by people was Pali language, and therefore it was Pali that was used to compile the teachings of the Buddha in the beginning, and therefore Pali becomes the foundational teaching of the Buddha, the Pali tradition of Buddhism. So they have a very good Vinaya, the monastic discipline practice. And later, in the Vulture Mountain, the Buddha gave teaching on the perfection of wisdom teachings, sutras, which was taught in the language of sutra, language of Sanskrit. So I have met people who also said that the Buddha did not know Sanskrit at that time. So who would be more knowledgeable, Master Nagarjuna or us today? So Master Nagarjuna lived a few centuries after the Buddha, and so he was closer to the Buddha. And we are living at a time when it's over 2,500 years since the Buddha passed away. And therefore, regarding the Indian history, Master Nagarjuna would know better. And he was not someone quite stubborn or foolish. He was a very clever, intelligent person, had an intelligent brain. He was not only a religious scholar, but he also knew Sanskrit. So, Master Nagarjuna, as Mula Madhyamaka Karika and Pramana Vartika by Dharmakirti are considered excellent pieces of writing in Sanskrit. And so, the teaching of the Buddha Master Nagarjuna in his Mula Madhyamaka Karika uses reason to demonstrate the truth of the teaching of the Buddha, although he sometimes states the scriptures. And so he also was someone who knew medicine as well. So he was not someone who was foolish. He was a very intelligent person. And one Hungarian person once told me, a scholar told me, that the Master Nagarjuna didn't know, Buddha didn't know Sanskrit. But Master Nagarjuna says that the perfection of wisdom teachings were given by the Buddha, taught by the Buddha in Sanskrit. And so when the Buddha gave this teaching, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, so the teachings of the Buddha that were compiled in Pali language during the first council of Buddhism, the Sanskrit teachings, such as the Perfection of Wisdom, did not become part of that compilation. The teaching of the Mahayana teaching is said to be the teaching of the Buddha by Master Nagarjuna, and also Bhavaviveka and Shandideva in his Bodhisattva Charya Avatara. And so the teachings that are contained in Pali language seems to have been the popularly known teachings at that time. And then the Sanskrit teachings, such as the Prajaparamita teachings, were not known publicly, amongst the general public. For example, if you look at the Heart Sutra, you find that in the Heart Sutra there was discussion between Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara. And so if someone were there who did not have any access to Avalokiteshvara at that time, and was able to see Shariputra talking, might think that Shariputra is talking to himself. And so Avalokiteshvara, Maitreya, Manjushri, and so forth were amongst the audience of the Buddha at that time in the form of deity, in deity forms. And therefore, it was not could not have been seen by the common people, generally speaking. So if the Panchaparamita teachings were not taught by the Buddha, and Buddha only taught the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, then the creme de la creme of the teaching of the Buddha would be absent. So if you really understand the teaching of the study, the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, you will really see the profundity and the cream of the teaching of the Buddha, could be extracted, from there. If the Buddha didn't teach give these teachings, then we would also have to say that Nagarjuna was more learned than the Buddha. That cannot be the case. And so because of the difference in the spiritual capacities of the disciples, there are different versions of the Perfection of Wisdom teachings. In China, for example, there is a very extensive teaching of the Perfection of Wisdom. And according to the sharpness of the disciples and also the mental capacity of the disciples, these Perfection of Wisdom teachings were given. by the Buddha, perhaps at one time, but the different disciples, according to their own dispositions, could have heard differently. And this, the Diamond Kata Sutra is a part of that perfection of wisdom teachings, which is shorter than the other perfection of wisdom teachings, like the 8,000 verses and so forth, but the longer than the Heart Sutra. And then there are other teachings of the Buddha, such as the Sutra, which was taught at around the time of passing away. And so the Pali tradition becomes the foundation of Buddhism for all the followers of the tradition of the Buddha. And sometimes we tend to put down the Pali tradition, saying that, oh, this is the Hinayana teaching. So that's wrong. For example, if you leave out Vinaya, the monastic discipline that is in the Pali tradition, I mean, how can you practice the Bodhisattva path and also go on to the Tantric path? Therefore, without the foundation of the Vinaya, you cannot practice the other two. And then Tantra teachings are connected with the second turning of the teachings of the second and third turning of the wheel of Dharma. So now, there's no explanatory transmission of this sutra, but I received the reading transmission from Venerable Tisur Rinpoche, the Rizong Rinpoche. So in the Indian language, Arya Vajrachetaka, Nama Panchaparamita, Mahayana Sutra in the language of Tibet, and then Prabhupada Paradachimba Tebo Chimbudo, the Doji Shabashija Tebo Chimbudo. And then in Tibet, there are about 100 volumes in the Gangyur, the translated words of the Buddha, and then over 220 volumes in the Tengyur, the translated treatises of the Indian masters. In India, there were the Mahasangika, Mulya Sarvastivada, and Theravada, and Mankur, and then Mankur tradition of lineage of the Vinaya tradition. So there are these four root Vinaya lineages. In the Theravada countries, they have the Theravada tradition. And then in Tibet, the Mulasarvastivada tradition of Vinaya is followed since Master Abbot Chandrakshita established the monastic ordination tradition in Tibet that has come down through Master Nagarjuna. And so there are about 13 volumes of Vinaya in Tibetan, and then about 20 to 25 volumes of Perfection of Wisdom teachings, sutras, and so forth. So in all, there are about 100 volumes of Gangyur. And then with regard to the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra, in Chinese, in Tibetan, we have 6 volumes, whereas I have heard that in Chinese, there are more number of volumes than this. So does anyone know how many? His Holiness was inquiring. So the Mula Sarasvati Vada tradition that Tibetans are following comes through the, and is the one that has come down through Master Nagarjuna, in the lineage of Master Nagarjuna, which was passed . So in Chinese, there are four volumes of the Avatamsaka Sutra. Someone was replying. And five volumes. And then Perfection of Wisdom. So the person was saying that it is in 80 sections and 5 volumes, whereas, the Avatamsaka Sutra, and then the Perfection of Wisdom, 10 volumes in Chinese. When I was in Japan once, in a library, there is a commentary on Perfection of Wisdom teaching, which was said to be have been written by Master Nagarjuna. I was quite doubtful, because if there were such an extensive commentary on Panchaparamita teachings by Nagarjuna, and Master Chandrakirti and his disciples and followers would have used them to quote from Master Nagarjuna, but none of them have done that. So in Chinese, perhaps there are these numerous volumes of which was ascribed to Master Nagarjuna, a commentary commentary on Perfection of Wisdom. So the title of this treatises, such as Buddha Palita, was named after the author himself. And then there are the titles given according to the content of the text. For example, in this case, the Perfection of Wisdom is the content. So one Amdo Lama, who had a sharp tongue, has said that Tibetan Lamas have very long names. For example, in my case, my long name is Jitsun Jambel Ngawang Lobsang Yishi Tinsen Gyatso. But while they have long names, they're short in knowledge. Whereas Indian masters, like Buddha Palita, have short names, but their knowledge is very long or extensive. Disciples of Master Nagarjuna never quoted them. And so, from amongst the 100 plus volumes of Kanjur, perhaps there were 10 or so volumes which were translated from Chinese. And then in the Tengur, the exegetical treatises translated into Tibetan, there are over 200 volumes. So in order to show that they were not Tibetan, made by Tibetans, but that they were translated from India, the titles were given in Sanskrit, saying that in the language of India, Arya Vajracchedaka Nama Prajnaparamita Mahayana Sutra. So this indicates that Sanskrit titles are given by saying in the language of India. And then the text is called The Perfection of Wisdom, and so it's called the noble text of The Perfection of Wisdom. And so I thought that it could be interpreted in this way, not just to say that it's any kind of wisdom, but the wisdom which leads us to the final goal of enlightenment. And then the wisdom is the factor, the main factor, which actually leads one from lower stages to the higher stages, and for making progress along the path, and not those of the method aspect of the practice. And this wisdom is the wisdom which cuts the root of ignorance, that is the grasping at true existence of things, which is the root of all other mental afflictions and faults. And so the wisdom because it understands the truth as it is, the reality as it is, therefore it is also the title, given the title Vajra or diamond, because a diamond cannot be cut by others, but it can cut others. And in the similar way, this wisdom, realizing that the lack of true existence is the wisdom which cuts that the ignorance, and it can not be cut or by the ignorance. So I bow down to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. These words once I heard, the conqueror was reciting Shravasti in the park of Anathapindika in the gardens of Prince Jeta. In convocation with him was a great gathering of monks. And so the monks here could be those of monks on the Arya path, and who were listeners, as well as an immense number of bodhisattvas who were great beings. In the morning, then the conqueror donned his monk's robes and outer shawl, took up his sage's bell, begging bowl, and entered the great city of Shravasti for requesting his meal. After collecting the food, he returned from the city and partook of it. when he had finished eating, he put away the bowl and shawl, for he was a person who had given up eating in the latter part of the So the Buddha was someone who lived a life away from householders. He has moved away from householder life and living a very simple life. And he didn't have any, he was not living a luxurious life like us Tibetan lamas, and some Chinese lamas also maybe living a very luxurious life. So I knew one so you may have heard me saying this. In the south of Thailand, there was a place called Sirling, which is called translates as golden land of gold or island of gold. And I have met a Thai monk, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, and who wrote books on selflessness that is taught in the Prajaparamita text. And he was actually taking interest in Sanskrit tradition. Sanskrit text, and he was said to be giving teachings sitting on a rock. And when I saw that rock, and I felt really moved. This is really great, I felt. So if I were to tell people to set a rock here on which I could sit, I would sit to give teachings, many of them may not feel comfortable to do that. So if he were to ask someone to the attendants to set up a rock here instead of this throne, they would not be comfortable. And so I went to Thailand several times in the past, but later I couldn't go. And I went with the Thai monks on an arms round. And so we had to go barefoot, and because of the heat in Thailand, and it really burnt my, I really felt hot, and my feet got burnt. And in this place, Vajrasana, Bodh Gaya, around the stupa, there were some families who brought food, and we went to around the stupa begging for food to remind ourselves of the Buddha. Tushi Rinpoche also, the late Tushi Rinpoche was also there. Monks going on arms, begging for food in China? So we talk about the four ways of simplicity of a noble being in livelihood. So for us to take rebirth, and what happens is the karma that we have created is reinforced by craving and appropriation. And therefore, the sin's attachment is the factor which reinforces the karma, bringing about the samsaric life. The monks of Shakyamuni Buddha are said to live, are asked to live, to live a very simple life. So there was once a Tibetan monk from Ganden Changse Monastic College. And of the 12 different ways of living for monks, he lived one of them, which is to live in the forest without any roofs, under trees. So when he told me that one time he was sitting under a tree, and then a snake came by, and he felt scared. But then the snake just left him alone. And so to the Chinese practitioners, the Dharma brothers and sisters, I also want to suggest to live this life of simplicity of monks and nuns. The making money is going to be the work of the business people. And so it's important to live a simple life with little want and little, whereas you should not neglect your health as well. And so if your simplicity becomes a cause for causing your health and lose your health, that's not going to be good. And so you should take care of your health. And so in China, you have a very good practice or tradition of vegetarianism. which is admirable. And so the text says that the Buddha went on an alms begging round, and the monks like Subhuti, asked a question to the Buddha, and of course the Buddha has given teachings before that, and therefore the question arose. So it says, and now, O conqueror, what of those who have entered well into the way of the Bodhisattva? How shall they live? How shall they practice? How should they keep their thoughts? And then this is this did Subhuti ask, and then the conqueror spoke the following words in reply to Subhuti's question. O Subhuti, it is good, it is good. O Subhuti, thus it is, and does it. The one gun thus has indeed done benefit to the Bodhisattvas who are great beings. By granting them beneficial instructions, the one gun thus has indeed given clear direction to the Bodhisattvas who are great beings by granting them the clearest of instructions. And since it is so, O Subhuti, listen now to what I speak and be sure that it stays firmly in your heart. Therefore, I shall reveal to you how it is that those who have entered well into the path of Bodhisattva, the way of the Bodhisattvas, should live and how they should practice and how they should keep their thoughts. Thus I shall do, shall I do, replied the junior monk Subhuti, and he said to listen as instructed by the conqueror. The conqueror too then began with the following words. Subhuti, this is how those who have entered well into the way of the Bodhisattva must think to themselves as they feel the wish to achieve enlightenment. I will bring to Nirvana the total amount of living beings, every single one numbered among the ranks of living kind, those who were born of eggs, those who were born from womb, and so four types of birth are mentioned. And those who were born from warmth and moisture, those who were born miraculously, those who have a physical form, those with none, those with conceptions, and so forth. And so, as being, so it says, however, many living beings there are, in whatever realms there may be, anyone at all labeled with the name of living being, all these will I bring to total liberation, to Nirvana. So this shows how things are labeled, how a person or a being is merely labeled. Although these, when we look at or when we think of somebody, a living being or a person, I mean, they appear to have some kind of an independent objective existence to a mind, but then there is no such a way of existence in them. And all these will I bring to total Nirvana, to the sphere beyond all grief, where none of the paths of suffering person are left at all. Yet, even if I do manage to bring these limitless number of living beings to total Nirvana, there will be no living being at all who was brought to their total Nirvana. So this, while living a simple life, they should not neglect their health as well. And vegetarian is appreciated. And so, even these sentient beings, such as those of those sentient beings born from womb and so forth, of course, do exist. Yet they cannot be found when you search for the designated object, the beings, as it is said. Anyone at all labeled with the name of living being. And so, on the basis of the designation, based on the subject to the basis of designation, an animal or a sentient being is designated, and the designated object and the basis of designation are not the same. They are exclusive to each other. Nothing, therefore, can be found to have any objective independent existence, such as the quantum physicists say, and therefore it says it's merely labeled. And Master Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Karika says, what arises through dependence is said to be empty, that it is self-designated, and that is the middle way. So, sentient beings, if we are able to recognize that sentient beings do exist by way of designation, but there is nothing whatever in and of themselves as being, as independently, objectively existent being. Why is it so? Because, Subhuti, if a bodhisattva were to slip into conceiving of someone as a living being, then we could never call them a bodhisattva. Why is this so? Because, Subhuti, if anyone were to slip into conceiving of someone as a living being or something that lives or as a person, then we could never call them a bodhisattva. So, of course, the Vaibhashikas and so forth do assert that things have independent objective existence, whereas the bodhisattvas of sharp faculty would actually check whether it's possible that things could have any objective independent existence or not. Bodhisattva never called them a bodhisattva, which means that the bodhisattva who clings on to having some objective existence and things and beings and so forth cannot be an authentic or a fully qualified being, because this bodhisattva is someone who aspires to the state of omniscience, and when you cling on to that, you cannot reach that goal. And I say, O Subhuti, that a bodhisattva performs the act of giving without staying in things. They perform the act of giving without staying in any object at all.
Staying.
They perform the act of giving without staying in things that you see. They perform the act of giving without staying in sounds and without staying in smell, taste, or taste of things that you touch, or in object of thought. O Subhuti, Bodhisattvas perform the act of giving without conceiving of anything in any way as a sign. That is how they give. Why is it so? Subhuti, of the mountains of merit collected by anyone, any bodhisattva who performs the act of giving without staying, without fixation, this merit, O Subhuti, is not something that you could easily ever measure, O Subhuti. What do you think? Would it be easy to measure the space to east to us? So these show that, in other words, you should destroy all objectification in things, and then engage in the bodhisattva practices. So his Holiness was commenting on the how things exist and find that things are merely designated. And so earlier we found mention of merely designated through dependence. And so in Mula Madhyamaka Karika we find detailed explanation of this, that things are merely designated. Amongst the Chinese, is there anybody who has studied Mula Madhyamaka Karika? Because it is in your language. So So this is a very a precious text. I do read it whenever I have time, and I also recite and reflect on certain lines from the Mula Madhyamaka Karika as well. On a daily basis, I do reflect on a few stanzas from it. So you do recite the Heart Sutra in your monasteries. Sometimes if you could read and recite the one or two chapters of Mula Madhyamaka Karika, I mean, that would be something. So right in the beginning of Mula Madhyamaka Karika, there is mention of not from self, not from other, not from both, nor from without causes. So arisal from self is something that non-Buddhist traditions assert. And then arisal from an other is, of course, conventionally we can talk about some effect arising from a cause which is different or separate from it. But then, what is that other? If you were to look for its identity, you cannot find it at all within it. And so, whatever object you subject to this kind of scrutiny, nothing could be found to have any objective existence. So, in its nature, and then, or if the in as it is said in the 70 stanzas of emptiness on emptiness. If a product were to have any objective existence, it is not correct to say that it depends on other factors. And therefore, you cannot say that it depends on a cause as well. And so, through this kind of analysis of the birth from things that exist or do not exist. I mean, there are these kind of reasonings that are used to scrutinize the thing, whether things arise, has any kind of objective essence or identity, and whether things arise, effects arise from from things existing or non-existing, and so forth. And so, in the amongst the 27 chapters of Mula Madhyamaka Karika, how we fall into samsara, beginning with through that of ignorance and so forth, is taught in the 26th chapter, and then how things do not have any existence, the self does not exist independently, is taught in chapter 18. And then in chapter 24, it is taught how things have no objective existence. And then in the 22nd chapter also, it shows how things are dependently originated. And so if you actually study the Mula Madhyamaka Karika in this sequence, studying the 26th chapter, then 18th, then 24th, and then the 22nd chapter, you will see how you can bring the whole of Madhyamaka Karika into a comprehensive understanding of the whole text. And His Holiness was commenting on the So in Chinese, there are also there is the 400 verses of Arya Deva, and Buddha Palita does not exist. And the Chinese interpreter Jamyang Rinchen is telling his told His Holiness that he's in the process of translating it. And then Madhyamaka Avatara, there is translation. And then the Lamp of Wisdom by Master Bhavviveka is there in Chinese translation from the past. And so these texts must be considered as your textbooks for study of Buddhist philosophy. And next, so without remaining or fixating on form, one should practice giving. And so in the Heart Sutra, it is mentioned that the five aggregates are should be seen as no intrinsic existence. So the term even or also could be interpreted in two ways. In the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Buddha does not mention the person who goes in the rounds of rebirth in samsara, whereas he explains the processes of going into the rounds of samsaric birth. Although that during the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Buddha did teach the selflessness of person, so the selflessness of person in the sense that there is no no person or a self which governs the psychophysical aggregates. I mean, one could understand this if one actually is able to ascertain that there is no self which is permanent, single and autonomous. So this is what is taught in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. And then in the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, with regard to the form and its shape, color, and so forth, I mean, it is mentioned that there is no such thing as independently, objectively existing. In quantum physics also, this is said. And even the quantum physicists say that as long as there is an observer, there is an observed object. And so this is also what the Chidamatras say, that there's no, they also say that there's no external existence. And then within the Madhyamaka tradition, there are those who say that whatever there is, it is merely designated. There's nothing which can be asserted without dependence on others, and therefore nothing which is independent existence, and therefore how things exist is by way of dependence. And because things are dependent, they do not have any objective independent existence. And since that is why the Heart Sutra says form is empty. So the form is itself empty in and of itself, whereas emptiness is form means that because things are dependently arisen, therefore we can say there is a form, although independent intrinsic existence is not there. And so there are the two truths. The conventional truth, which is designated by way of worldly convention, as Master Chandrakirti says, there are the two ways in which things could exist. So, one is the conventional existence, which you do not do any kind of a critical scrutiny into the nature and reality of the things as such, but without doing any critical analysis, the things could be asserted by way of worldly convention. Whereas if you were to scrutinize the things, objects and so forth, I mean, nothing could be found which shows that things have no independent existence, which is not a denial of the existence of things, but denial of rejection of independent existence. And so in the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, it is said that not only the person or being, the designated object, is empty of independent or inherent existence, but even the psychophysical aggregates, which are the basis of designation of the person or being, do not have any independent existence. And so the term in this phrase, or the five psychophysical aggregates also are empty of inherent existence, means not only the person, but also the basis of designation, which are the psychophysical aggregates, are empty of any independent existence or their existence, and therefore form is empty, and emptiness is form, and so forth. So there are those monks, for example, in Thailand, the monks. Should start eating before 12 o'clock. And so monks who strictly follow this rule of monks, monastics, should do this. So bye-bye. See you again.